Next on the show this morning, Fran Michel talks about the ongoing struggle for a single-payer healthcare system in the United States, followed by our discussion of the healthcare of veterans.
This Memorial Day, we might pause to remember those who have died in Oregon for lack of health insurance. As Chris Lowe notes on the Healthcare for All Oregon webpage, 2009 estimate by Physicians for National Healthcare Program was that there were about 560 such deaths in Oregon that year. The annual order of magnitude is probably the same today. In the next few years, it may decline a bit due to Oregon health plan expansion and Cover Oregon coverage, but there will still be hundreds of such deaths per year. End quote. Indeed, since the Affordable Care Act will cover about only half of those previously uninsured, we can expect that number to drop by half. So perhaps next year, only about 280 people will die in Oregon because of lack of health insurance. Bummer if you or yours are among those thrown under the bus, but hey, it's still an improvement, right? There probably will not be many fewer bankruptcies because of medical costs. In fact, there may even be more than the 1,000 each month currently in Oregon. According to a Harvard study looking at data from 2007, in about 60% of personal bankruptcies, medical costs played a significant role, and in about 75% of those cases, the people involved were insured. As one of the co-authors of the Harvard study, Dr. Stephanie Woolhandler, has observed, the federal health law will make the problem of gaps in coverage much more serious because the required insurance policies under the legislation are extremely skimpy. Yet the premiums are often remarkably high. So where is all that money going, since it's apparently not going to pay for medical costs? Well, if you're insured through Providence Health and Services, some undisclosed amount of it paid the Portland Timbers for naming rights to the Major League Soccer team's home stadium, now called Providence Park. Private insurance overhead and profit, on average, fluctuate between 12% and 14% nationally. This figure is somewhat lower than the 16 to 20% at many of the big insurers because it includes self-insured plans of many big employers that have overhead of about 6 to 7%. On the other hand, overhead in the individual market is often substantially higher than 20% and in some cases above 30%. Why is all this administrating so costly? Compensation for executives accounts for much of it. The CEOs of Fortune 500 health insurance companies made an average of over $13 million each last year, up more than $2 million from the year before. No doubt they deserved it for increasing shareholder value. The so-called Affordable Care Act has been a boon for insurance companies. For the first time, Americans are legally obligated to buy a private product. In contrast to these figures, Medicare has an overhead of about 2%, and last year its top administrator was paid less than $200,000. Now, you might think that single-payer Medicare for all is a pipe dream, that we missed the chance to create a system that provided health care for everyone instead of mandating that everyone give money to insurance companies. But you'd be wrong. Vermont has a plan to 2017 launch of the nation's first universal healthcare system, a sort of modified Medicare for all that will cover everyone in the state and reduce costs. Remember 5 years ago when they became the first state to permit same-sex marriage? One of the key steps Vermont took in developing their health plan was to commission a study that explored the possible options, costs, and strategies for providing healthcare for everyone in the state. The Oregon legislature has approved a similar study, but has not provided funding for it. So the Healthcare for All Oregon Education Fund is collecting donations to fund the study, which will provide essential information to give legislators and voters the confidence to take action. If you're interested in finding out more, you can turn out Friday, June 6th, to hear James Haslam, executive director of the Vermont Workers Center, who will be in Portland to provide advice and inspiration. That event begins at 6 p.m. at the SEIU 503 Ballroom at 6401 Southeast Foster. You can also register for the Healthcare for All Oregon membership meeting, which takes place on Saturday, June 14th from 10:30 to 4 at the Portland First Unitarian Church, Fuller Hall at 1211 Southwest Main Street. And this Wednesday, you can join others at Portland City Hall at 9:15 a.m. to demand disclosure of the amount of money spent on renaming Providence Park. Wear red to show your support for Healthcare for All Oregon. The Healthcare for All Oregon website, hcao.org, also has more information as well as guides to writing to your legislators and talking with your friends and neighbors about the issue, and blank petition forms to help you gather support. Advocates supporting the statewide effort to bring publicly funded universal health care to all Oregon residents know that the effort will not be easy. The size and power of the healthcare industry lobby is legendary. The struggle will require a strong and determined grassroots movement, with advocates all over the state demanding justice. But Healthcare for All Oregon is working to build the infrastructure to support legislative and ballot initiative victories. Because healthcare should not be a commodity on the market, it is a human right. As Lowe suggests, this Memorial Day, remembering those who died for lack of healthcare does not in any way dishonor the military dead or disrespect anyone else's use of the day for remembering the departed. Quote, in fact, one significant group who die prematurely in our current system for lack of care come from among the homeless military veterans who are failed so miserably by our society, to our shame. Failure of medical care is among the ways we fail them. This is especially true in the many cases of servicemen and women who suffered officially unrecognized PTSD or other mental health injuries, sometimes unrecognized by deliberate policy of commanders, contributing to them getting bad discharges that make them ineligible for veterans' benefits. Others who are failed are loved ones of ex-service members. Both military service and lack of insurance are found disproportionately among lower-income Americans. Veterans who may get care through the VA may not be able to ensure that their relatives or friends have care. The death toll from lack of health care is also a marker for a wider realm of pain and debility, reduced quality of life, and stress and suffering for family and friends of the untreated ill, dying, and dead. End quote. In recognizing that toll, we have all the more reason to fight like hell for the living. Apparently, there's also some public worry about veterans dying here at home while waiting for health care. Stephen Colbert joked on his show last week that the right wing has finally found an actual scandal to mobilize around in their relentless attacks on Obama. The scandal began with reports of deaths of patients on waiting lists for treatment and staff manipulation of records to cover up the problem of long waiting lists. National Review editor Rich Lowry rages that the VA is a socialist paradise with no insurance companies, no private doctors, no competition. Describing the VA as an island of socialism in American healthcare, Lowry cites the recent crisis as an example of a Soviet-style dysfunctional bureaucracy. Jan, you carried out research at the VA in your recent film project on mental health practices in the military. What did you find out in doing your research?
Well, the VA clinics and healthcare centers, which includes hospitals and a range of clinics and nursing homes, cemeteries. I mean, it's quite an expansive system intended to provide an array of service for those who serve in the military. I mean, it's no socialist paradise, but nor is it the hell that critics claim. And if there is a hell, it's often the hell brought to the staff there and these centers by the stories and wounds, some visible, some not, of veterans. One of the social workers I interviewed at the Portland VA Center described the sadness that staff often carry as they care for veterans, as well as the outrage at times over the wars that got them there. She referred to a plaque displayed on the large atrium wall that you see when you enter the VA up on center up on the hill, and it says something like, "What you see here is the price of freedom." She said, "What that plaque should really say is, what you see here is the price of war." Indeed, entering a VA hospital, sitting in the waiting area, provides a kind of palpable window into the long-term consequences of military service and the chronic conditions of many veterans who generally get very good care. In a 2012 book called Best Care Anywhere, Philip Longman tells the story of the turnaround, actually, of the Department of Veterans Affairs healthcare system from a pretty dysfunctional bureaucracy in the 90s into what he claims is a benchmark for high-quality medicine overall in the United States. And the book, which suggests that it should be an example for the single-payer system as a whole, is supported by considerable research comparing the VA system to other healthcare organizations in the U.S., organizations from RAND to the RAND Corporation to various national health studies, claim that overall, veterans have more efficient, effective care than comparable systems in the private sector, And the care is done more cheaply in a way that specifically addresses their needs. So even though now many conservatives are calling for a voucher system and there are some vouchers that will continue to be distributed to handle veterans on wait lists, most veterans associations, including the American Legion, oppose a voucher system and privatizing the VA and are overall quite happy with the VA system in spite of the enormity of its tasks and its ongoing problems.
So its problems, for instance, its wait times are not really that much worse than privately run hospitals, or is there a difference because of the nature of the population that they're serving, or is there a difference? Is there a problem? How does it compare to private hospitals?
Given the enormity of the demands on the VA, which not only include healthcare services, both acute and chronic, but also managing an enormous and in many ways unwieldy benefit system, which perhaps we should return to later, the disability benefit system really is a gateway into healthcare for many underemployed or unemployed or poor service members, veterans. You know, there's been this enormous outcry about the 2-month waiting lists of veterans at some of the VA clinics. And yet, in one comparable study, people in Los Angeles waited an average of 59 days. In Boston, they waited an average of 63 days. In Washington, D.C., it was 30 days.
And that's in private hospitals rather than VA hospitals in those cities.
Yeah, and VA hospitals have enormous tasks. There also are places where veterans act out a lot of their anger. Some of the staff talked about, you know, violence of veterans who come in, many still armed, are used to being armed, which becomes kind of a psychological kind of form of armor after they leave service, and sometimes displace their anger toward the military that often dumps them at the end of their service. There's a tremendous focus on group solidarity, camaraderie, we're all in a family. When your service is over, that's it. So unless you're in the active component, which is professional military, and if you are in the Guard or the Reserve units, which are a large part of the military veteran population, you kind of get dumped. And they have been working on that transition from the Department of Defense to the VA. So what a lot of staff get is the rage and sadness as well as trauma, which of course gets talked about a lot, but not so much how the distress of war produces rage and veterans getting very angry and upset. And it's harder to direct that towards the remote military, the Department of Defense, than those staff members, the nurses and clinic staff at your local VA, which is not to say there are not problems there, but it's kind of overdetermined by military experience and war in general.
And is it shaped at all by questions of funding cuts? Has the VA been, as the right sometimes says, you know, is this a case of starving the beast? Is there a problem with understaffing or lack of resources to provide the services that veterans need?
Yeah, and it's much like the public schools in areas where problems are chronic. And in the VA, a lot of problems are chronic. Staff told me that one of the main healthcare ongoing complaints is back pain, as well as chronic mental health problems, such as PTSD. But there are other ongoing, you know, people served during World War II are still accessing VA services and often applying for disability benefits. So the nature of chronic problems that are not so easily resolved as they are in affluent communities where there's an acute medical situation and then it's resolved and people have an underlying state of health. So there's that issue. There's also a confound here in that the VA was among the first of the healthcare systems to track their waiting lists and access to care. So data is often a product of the data you gathered. And they've been quite forward-looking in really monitoring many aspects of veterans' needs and care. So there's also that issue that it's always a little compared to what? And we don't have good comparative data, particularly on perhaps a good comparator would be county clinics in underserved areas around the country who face similar problems and populations.
So the problem is partly the particularly difficult and large nature of the population that they're serving. It's partly problems of resources and funding. It's partly problems of the severity and chronic health problems that are characteristic of often low income otherwise underserved populations. So the VA is a system that is, in addition to having some gaps between the different systems of healthcare in the country moving from the Department of Defense to the VA, there are also problems with the nature of the population and the lack of resources.
And the lack of a single-payer healthcare system in this country. The most common access to VA for people who are not in the active component is through a disability benefit, which ranges from 10 to 100%. A low-level disability will allow you access to health care in the VA. So I think it's an interesting question what level of disability we would have associated with war if we had a fully funded single-payer health care system in this country.
Thanks, Jan.